I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, it's great to have you with us. And if you like this little podcast and you're listening on, I don't know, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, or something like that, and you think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to tell everyone how much I love Book Off? Well, why not write us a little review and click five stars. Yeah, five stars. I think that's probably what you want to do.
I'm going to do that.
And Greg is going to do that. He's going to do that right after this episode. Well, let's see how it goes, Greg. Let's see how this goes.
You sold it to me straight away.
You might be going down to three or two stars, depending on how the next 30 minutes unfold. And that, off mic, is the voice of my first guest, a theatre director, playwright, actor and author who founded the Criterion New Writing Programme at the Criterion Theatre in London, believe it or not. He's written, produced and staged 25 plays and musicals, taught creative writing and created the innovative website mosslabyrinth.com, the world's first online accessible 3D world. Here to tell us about his debut novel, it's Greg Moss. Welcome to you.
That sounds like my cue.
It is your cue. Five stars.
Fantastic. Five stars it is. Can I get the five stars for The Coming Darkness, which is my future thriller set in 2037?
Yes.
An agent of the French security services.
Yes.
Clearly has to try and save the world.
Yes.
What more do you need to know?
Five. Done.
Thank you.
Just written it down there. You do a book off review and I'll do a Goodreads or Amazon or something.
That's
in return. That's how we'll get. It's lovely to have you with us. And my second guest was barred from watching films and television by his parents, so he developed an early interest in reading, thanks to a local library. God bless him. After studying philosophy at University College London, he became involved in centre-left politics, entering into journalism soon after. He has sold, ladies and gentlemen, just counting them, 180 million books worldwide, which include the international bestsellers Eye of the Needle and The Pillars of the Earth, as well as the Kingsbridge series and Century Trilogy. You know who it is. It's Ken Follett. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for both being here in London town in our lovely little studio. And I have to say, I know you met for coffee earlier. Was that planned or was that just sort of because you were both in the area?
It was an accident, actually.
Yeah. I stalked him all the way from Trafalgar Square. He didn't notice.
But this is the first time I've met Greg, but I know his wife very well indeed, Kate Moss.
Yes, indeed. So you
that sounds a bit dodgy, doesn't it? Yeah. No, wait a minute.
I'm going to roll with that.
Just go with it. Well, it's great to have you both here. And over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to talk about both your brilliant new novels. We're going to get a little bit of an insight into your writing, find out what you've been reading and enjoying recently. And, of course, we will do the book off, where each of you tells us, or pitches us a book that you love, that you think we should all read. We'll come to that shortly. Ken, you've never been short of ambition when it comes to writing books, and Never, your latest novel, is no exception here, because in it you explore the imminent threat of World War III. Lovely light topic just to get into. Perhaps you could set up the rather epic story that you've written here for those that don't know it yet.
It was inspired by the events that led up to the First World War, particularly in July 1914, because when I studied that, for a book called Fall of Giants, I realised that nobody wanted that war. The national leaders, the presidents and emperors and prime ministers of Europe, actually tried very hard to avoid that war. And yet they all made decisions that step by little step took us closer to the World War. And having figured that out, the next thought that occurred to me was, could it happen again? Could there be a war that nobody really wanted? And then, of course, came the thought that is always the beginning of one of my books. Could I write a story about that? And, of course, the answer was yes, I could.
That's a brilliant idea. That's fantastic.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
And in some ways, Ken, it's more than a thriller. And by that, I mean you've got the action, you've got the danger, you've got the suspense. But it seems to me that you really wanted in this book, as the reader, to know your characters, really get into their stories as much as actually enjoy a page-turning plot. Was that conscious?
Yeah, absolutely conscious, and yeah. I think it's completely essential. You know, the plot is one thing where there's suspense and what's going to happen next, but you don't care enough about that unless you care about the people involved in it. So it's really basic. Whatever's happening, people in danger, there's suspense, people falling in love, none of that matters unless you create characters that people can believe in and sympathise with and root for. Because, I mean, that's what keeps us turning the pages. For me, it is, anyway, and I think for a lot of people, you turn the pages because you suddenly care about what's going to happen to these characters. And isn't that weird? I mean, you know that this was written by Follett sitting at his desk and making it up. And yet, and of course I do it too. I mean, I'm reading something by Lee Child and I'm thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen now? Yeah. I know Lee. And he's there with a cigarette in his mouth in his flat in New York. And he's thinking, what's Reacher going to do now? So, that's the miracle of literature. But you have to believe, it's very basic. You have to believe that those characters could be like that. People could be like those characters. And you have to believe that these events could really happen.
But unlike Lee Child, who is sat there thinking, what's Reacher going to do now? You, of course, know, because you are a planner, Ken, and he is very much a let's see what happens.
Yes, we're absolutely contrary methods of working. Yes, I take a long time. I write a plan. I call it an outline of the book. And that takes me between 6 months and a year. Because in order to get this page-turning effect, the other thing you have to have is there sort of has to be a reason on every page to turn over and see what's on the next page. And some people can do that just intuitively. Mm. I know Freddie Forsyth slightly, and I talked to him about this. And he doesn't write an outline. He thinks about it a lot. But when he sits down to write, he just goes straight through it and does it quite quickly. And that's what Lee does. And what do you do, Greg?
Well, I do a combination of the two. I'm in between the two. But what I was going to say, Ken, is if you know what the future for your characters feels like, you can write towards that, can't you? If you know the mood that you're going to arrive at the end of the chapter, the end of the next section, then that directs how you write. I think that's the middle ground that I'm in, I think.
Yeah. So whatever's happening, the principal characters are hoping for something or afraid of something, or afraid of one thing and hoping for another. Mm. And
that's better still, isn't it?
Yes,
if there's competing objectives, yes, that's the best.
Yes, and then so as you move towards that, you can focus on their hopes and fears, or if you want, and this is very good to do occasionally, you can completely misdirect the reader.
Yeah.
So the reader thinks it's going in one direction, and so the end of the chapter comes and they go, oh, my God, I wasn't expecting
that. But what you do brilliantly is you make that completely natural. It's not a deception. It's natural that the reader should think that that's the path it's taking.
Oh, yes.
And then, of course, it's plausible when you switch it round.
Yeah. And that you said sort of 6 to 12 months for the outline, and then another sort of year or two to actually write the draft and then the finished edit.
A year for the first draft and a year for the rewrite.
Gosh. And how long did it take you, Greg, for this debut novel?
Listen, it was lockdown.
Oh, right.
I had my profession in theatre was literally made illegal overnight.
Yeah.
And so I had nothing else to distract me. And there I was in my study, in my IKEA Poang chair with its footstool and the laptop on my lap, on the tray table, which, you know, the sort of thing that grannies have with beads underneath.
Oh, I know
in a bag
exactly.
And,
yes, love it.
Sort of thing for doing a crossword or eating your beans on top. Yes. So that's where I sat every morning from about sort of 6.30 till 10 or 10.30. And ridiculously, I know you'll appreciate this, produced far too many words. And then, of course, my publisher and editor have been helping me to refine it and make it, hopefully, a page-turner rather than a sequence of dull despair.
I used to know the late Ed McBain, who wrote a series of police procedurals about the 87th Precinct in a town very like New York. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, when I met him, I had read all his books, and there are 30 or 40. I said to him, you often start a book on the first of the month. The story begins on the first of the month and ends on the last day of the month. I said to him, and I often wonder whether you actually wrote it, you know, starting on the first and finishing on the last day of the month. And he looked at me and he said, sometimes faster.
Oh, damn you.
I know. Whereas... Kate Moss, my wife, she is often frustrated at the process of writing novel, say, 7, because her mind is already brewing novel 8. You get that? you want to be finished with this one because the next one is desperate for your attention.
No, I don't. I mean, but it is tempting. I know, because sometimes an idea occurs to you and you think, that's good. And you start to think, and what I could do, and then you think, no. Stop, wait, follow it, leave it. You've got to finish this one first. But I understand the temptation.
And your plots are so intricate and complex that they need all your attention. Absolutely. It's not like you can drift off.
You can't, you can't make it up as you go along.
No. And what, maybe it was the lockdown then, Greg, but I was going to ask what sort of drew you to a dystopian novel, because this is what it is. This is set in a alternate but quite near future. What was it that drew you to write this?
I can share a secret with you. When I started writing, you know how you have a work in progress title and you're not sure if that's what it's going to be?
Yeah.
I put 2048 because it was sort of in homage to Orwell.
Yep.
You know, 1948, 1984, 2048. Yep. And then I decided that was too far ahead because I wanted the future, 2037, as I decided, to be like today, but more so, not actually a different world. And so I chose to just go a generation, not even a generation ahead. So that was that sort of train of thought. And then when I say today, but more so, what I mean by that is that it's not all black, because, of course, it is now impossible, isn't it, to take seriously climate change deniers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's absurd.
It is, yes.
And they are constantly shifting their ground because they know that they're absurd now. And, of course, by 2037, there must be concerted action from that unchallenged consensus, at least unchallenged by anybody the most self-deluding.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really how I placed it in that future. And, of course, because it's a thriller, it's a happy ending, isn't it? And wouldn't you say you do this too? Well, I mean, I don't do it anywhere near the skill that you do, but this is what I would say about it. It's much easier to write a tragedy where everything tends towards despair, and sure enough, that's where it ends up. But to write a happy ending where out of all kinds of misunderstanding and problems and awful circumstances and concealments and lies, you still get a happy ending, albeit, you know, mitigated by reality. That's harder, isn't it?
Much harder, yeah. And you have to do something clever often, but it must never be something that makes the reader think how clever you were to make it turn out like this. The reader must see it as a perfectly natural thing to happen, but still be surprised and pleased by it.
And you feel impatient as you write towards it, don't you? And it must be, I don't know, maybe 85% of the way through that key thing happens that's probably foreshadowed somewhere near the beginning.
Oh, yes.
Which unlocks that positive ending.
Yes, that's right. But the reader must never think about the author, in my opinion. No. Must never think, oh, he's clever to do that. Must always be, the reader must be thinking about the characters, not
yeah.
about me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you do too. You feel deeply for your characters, don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you have to because... And the other thing is, other people in the story must feel deeply for them.
Mm.
And that's why there's always a love story in my books.
Yeah.
Because there's somebody who's in danger. Okay, I want the reader to think, my goodness, I hope it all turns out okay for that person. But you also want somebody else in the story who's in love with that woman or that man and is thinking, oh, my God, I couldn't bear it if it goes wrong for her or for him. And that's a much stronger way to create empathy for the characters, I think.
Mm. Talking of great characters, I love Alexander in your book, Greg.
Thank you.
Did he come first or did the story come first? And can you just set up this story for our listeners?
So imagining this future in which everything is like today, but more so, and therefore more threatening, I began to think about the hyper-connected world, you know, the corporations that span continents and collect our data and abuse it. And it struck me that governments are in a sort of arms race to do the same thing. And then I thought that if you were an agent working for the security services of the French government, you would perhaps feel that that wasn't an entirely unalloyed good, that you were part of that machine of surveillance and manipulation of media and populations. And that's Alexandre Lamarque. That's where he starts. He's sent on a mission to a genetics laboratory in Norway with the goal of stealing their data. And realises in doing so, for the best of reasons, at least so he's been told, and he realises in doing so that he can't be the good guy.
Mm.
Can he? If they're the good guys. Mm. They're the scientists who are doing their best to create novel medicines for this age of transgenic viruses to solve awful problems for the world's poorer populations. And he's swanning in, and with his brilliant future technology, he's stealing it.
Do you think that authors are contributing to the advancement of technology and, you know, thinking of the future of climate change, the fight of climate change? Do you think that writers are having an effect on that?
Well, when I was a very young man, your age, for example,
very young,
I read a lot of science fiction. I would read Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke.
Me too.
And that speculative science fiction was incredibly prescient, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great, yeah.
I think we can see the same thing today in a well-made show like Doctor Who. You know, there's lots of predictions about the future when the Doctor travels to the future, aren't there, that are sort of satisfying and plausible, like Ken was saying just now, in our plot mechanisms.
Yeah,
that's fundamental to make it satisfyingly plausible.
Yeah, well, sci-fi writers of the past and some of the ones you just mentioned there have been credited with inventing things, or certainly putting down on the page things that then turned into being.
The satellite network, Arthur C. Clarke predicted that, I think, in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And do you remember the mobile phones in the first series of Star Trek? No, you're too young. You might remember, Greg. they all had mobile phones, and they were the type that flip open and you speak into the lid.
They were flip phones.
Oh,
flip
wow.
phones, that's right.
Wow.
But isn't it a question of imagination? So in Kate's new non-fiction book, Warrior Queens and Quiet Revolutionaries, she talks about more than a thousand women who've changed history, but perhaps you or I haven't ever heard of.
Yeah.
So one day, a woman thought to herself, this, after a dinner party, is a lot of washing up, and started imagining a machine that could do that for her, and invented, surprise, surprise, the dishwasher. And it took her, obviously, a long time to develop it, make it work, and patent it, and popularise it and commercialise it.
And and we don't know her name, or you probably do, Greg.
I can't remember.
I can't remember.
It's popped out of my head. But that's
in the book.
Exactly. That's the sort of brilliant story, which is, as you're saying, Joe, it's a product of imagination, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then you make it real.
Yeah.
Or in our case, we make it real in our fictional world.
In our fictional world, exactly, yeah. And you've mentioned Kate, your wife, who I know very well, like Ken, and I just wondered what it's like to be married to, I don't know, best-selling novelist, when you write your book and think, shall I share it with you, darling? Or did she get a first read?
Yeah, always.
And did she give constructive feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. But, of course, all those plays you were talking about so kindly earlier,
yes,
she was first reader on all of those as well.
Right.
And there's three things I'd say. I'm sorry, I don't want to go on about this, but there's three things I'd
Please
say.
Please go on, I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
Do go on.
Three things that I'd say that Kate brings which are unique to her. So there is, first, this unique, subjective, creative sensibility out of which she grows her plots and her, mm-hmm. her characters. And then there is this almost austere editorial competence that she applies to it. You know, that's an objective thing. And then in addition, and here I'm incredibly lucky, she has this long professional experience because she was a publishing director, an editor and publishing director of the industry. And of course, I've absorbed that like a happy sponge.
Perfect then.
Yes.
Do you have a first reader, Ken?
Well, I show my first drafts to a lot of people. Mm. Barbara's one of them, my editors in London and New York. I usually hire specialists, often university professors, in the subject that I'm writing about. Ah. I pay them quite well because I want them to take it very seriously and read the first draft and look for errors and suggest corrections and suggest alternative if I've done something that couldn't possibly happen, as it were, in Never, for example. A lot of the action takes place in Beijing. Mm. So I had people who've been there and who study the Chinese government and the Chinese secret service, and one of them might say that couldn't possibly happen in Beijing. That's the sort of thing that happens in London and New York, but not him. That sort of thing. Mm. And so that although I do all the initial research myself, I have people who can correct.
Yeah.
But really the most important is the people who say, and some of these are friends of mine who just happen to be good readers. Some of them will say, I'm trying to think of an example in what I'm writing on at the moment, writing about at the moment. We'll say, this scene just didn't convince me. I just didn't think that would happen. I didn't think that man would make that decision. And I'll look at it again. And 9 times out of 10, I change it. Mm. Occasionally, I will think, no, it's got to be like that. But mostly, I think, OK, this person didn't believe it. That's fatal. Mm. I've really got to do something about that. And so that process of reviewing is very important to me.
And that's so interesting. You mentioned the experts that you bring in, because I was thinking specifically about Never and how incredibly detailed it is in terms of the authenticity of everything. I felt like you'd gone above and beyond, and obviously you have, in terms of getting the details of all these nuclear weapons and sites and places in the world absolutely spot on.
Yes, and it's a lot of work, although, like most authors, I quite enjoy the research because it's so much easier than writing.
You can still call it work, you know.
But yes, things like, let's take the White House, because a lot mm-hmm. of the action takes place in the White House in Never, and one of my advisors said to me, for example, that meeting would never be held in that room.
Oh, that's so good.
And, you know, so people who have that kind of intimate Brilliant. Knowledge of something. I've been to the White House myself and been around it.
Oh, have you?
Been to meetings there. Yeah, yeah. In the old, you can't go there now, but it was much easier, you know, 10 years ago. But nevertheless, you know, I had people who could say that kind of thing, what kind of meeting would take place in what kind of location. And there is a what they call a situation room. What a stupid name. It's a crisis room, really. But yeah. In the basement, the situation room, and descriptions of that and how people operate in that. You know, I was able to, if it's something I couldn't actually research myself, I was able to find people who knew, who had been there and done that.
Mm, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. And then, of course, because every good story, Joe, every good story is essentially a bit of a stretch, Okay, it's, you know, if it's not a bit of a stretch, it may not be a very good story. So it's got to be a bit of a stretch. So a lot of what you're doing is making it convincing, making it real. And if you put in some actual details, it creates an aura of reality, and you're slightly extravagant story becomes more believable.
Yeah, very good. And you alluded to a new idea there. Are you writing another novel at the moment?
Oh, yes, I am. Well, I finished Never about 18 months ago, and I never stop. I don't stop. but, you know, I tell myself, you know, you ought to have at least a couple of weeks when you're not actually writing.
Why?
and then after 10 days, you know, 10 days of doing nothing, blow this for a game of soldiers and I start work on the next book. It's, you know what Noel Coward said? They asked him why he didn't retire and he said, because work is so much more fun than fun. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
And have you got the fiction bug now, Greg?
No, completely. Yes, completely. I have... So I'm writing the follow-up to The Coming Darkness, which is called The Coming Storm, and that should be published 12 months on, so it'll be November 23. And I have another series that I'm working on, which has not yet been announced. But so, yes, I agree with you, and I agree with Noel Coward.
That's a good person to be in agreement with.
Kent Follett and Noel Coward, they're in the triangle with me.
That's a great triangle.
Also a bit dodgy.
Yeah. No.
I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently. The classic question that people throw at me where I just... look at them blankly and can't remember the names of authors or titles of books or anything from the last 10 years. Luckily, I did prime you. I was nice enough to say, I'm going to ask you this. So, Ken, what have you been reading and enjoying recently, if anything?
The one that stayed with me, which I read a couple of weeks ago, is a novel called Half of a Yellow Sun. And it's not new. It's been out for about 10 years. Yes. So I'm late to the party as usual. But people talk about it so much and it's had so much attention and sold so well, I thought I'd have a look at it and it really grabbed me. It's set in Nigeria at the time of the Biafran War. So it's the background of politics and warfare, cruelty and starvation. And it's about a group of people who are caught up in all of this. They're on the most of the characters are on the Biafran side. It's awfully well done. The characters also have, as we were mentioning earlier, the characters have lives of their own outside the story. So it's not just about the war and the politics of the situation. It's about their marriages and love affairs and their children. And somebody once said to me, all great stories are actually about a family. I don't know if that's true, but a lot of them are. Hamlet, you know, that's a family drama, isn't it? And this certainly is a family drama within a war. And it grabbed me and kept me getting right until the end. Very, very good.
I think there's a similarity with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's novel and some of your works where small people, they're not small, of course, to the reader or for you, but small people in the context of society are victims of these huge forces that they can't control. Isn't that right?
Yes, to some extent, although for me, it's important that at least some of the characters are not just observers of the crisis. No. They must be involved in... They must be actors. So... the people in Never, for example, they're not just living through an international diplomatic crisis. They're part of it. They're making moves. The things they do change the crisis situation. And I think at least some of that is very important in any novel that takes history or even modern day international conflict as its background. I think you don't want to be just watching it. You want to be in it doing something.
And it's very satisfying, isn't it, to write a character who seems weak but achieves some power or authority within the story.
Can be, yes.
You see them grow and...
Yeah, that's a good trick. Yeah, somebody who doesn't seem very strong, although he or she has got some hidden strength which will gradually be revealed. That's very satisfying, yes.
Very.
Perhaps because we'd all like to feel we have some hidden strength that would come out in a crisis.
Oh, my God, yes.
Absolutely. What about you, Greg? What have you been reading and enjoying recently?
Can I offer you a sequence? I've read Anthony Horowitz's sequence of Hawthorne novels. Hawthorne is a very mysterious detective, no longer working for the Met. And Anthony Horowitz is, within the novel,
yes,
a protagonist and narrator.
Tony.
Exactly. Beautifully written, self-deprecating, very funny, but also the intrigues are incredibly satisfying too. Mm-hmm.
See, I could never do that. What use would Ken Follett be in a novel?
He'd just hidden depths, didn't you just say?
Well, I don't. There isn't anything very much hidden about me. Unfortunately, everybody knows everything about me. No, I would just be sitting there writing a book about it while it was all going on all around me.
Well, of course, that is what Anthony Horowitz, that Hawthorne calls Tony, really wants to be doing. He doesn't want to get drawn into these crimes.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I'd love to read a Ken Follett novel with Ken Follett in it, actually. I think that would be something...
Satisfyingly meta.
Really satisfyingly meta, yeah. Very full circle. Yes, I love those Horowitz books. And I remember when the first one came out and we did an event together. And hearing him talk about why he did it and what sort of made him want to do it. Because he, I think, like all great writers, he wanted to challenge himself a bit, I think. And it was the case that he thought, well... How can I take a new step in the sort of fiction that I've already been writing? I know, I'll plonk myself in it.
It is new. I don't think I've read novels quite like those. I really don't, not anywhere. And I've read, you know, I'm 61 years old. I've read a lot of books.
Yeah. Here's a conundrum.
Go on.
Some of Martin Amis's books, there's a character called John Self.
Mm,
yes.
Good point.
Very like Martin Amis. Mm. I've noticed recently that there's somebody who's been reviewing books, I think, for The Observer, called John Self. I wonder if is it Martin, or is there really a person called John Self?
You're a detective.
Oh, that's my role in the novel.
There you go.
Chief Superintendent Ken Follett. No, I don't think that works.
No.
That doesn't work.
And I don't know, Ken. I don't know. There's something there. Thank you both for those recommendations.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And now it's time for another, because it's time for the Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted to tell us about a book that you love, that you think everyone should read. Me, the listeners, everyone. I never say, oh, tell us your favourite book, because I don't. I think that's an impossible question. It's like, tell us your favourite song or album or book. I couldn't do it. I just could, and it would change. If you ask me now, it would be a different answer to later. So it's just a book that you absolutely love, that you think everyone will be enriched because they've read it. So before we get to hear your brilliant pitches, we have to do a little bit of admin. And usually I have with me my props, my trusty horn, the bicycle horn, and the school bell. I have forgotten those, and I'm going to blame that on the 5:30 a.m. alarm. So instead, we can either just sort of use...
That's very good. That's use tuneful. Bottle.
What do you think, Greg? Yeah, OK. Well, this is what I'm going to use then as your signal if you are still talking at
Is that a red traffic light, or is it only an amber warning?
Oh, it is a red traffic
light. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
You have to shut up.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I've cut down many a great author in their prime on this podcast and felt very bad about it. And yet it is the game. So that's, yeah, it's a red light. If you want, Craig, no one's ever asked. If you want, I can give you an amber.
No, I'm going to put my phone on the desk with the stopwatch running. And if you hear me accelerate, you'll know why.
Okay, so in lieu of my usual trusty props, we'll be using the water bottle. And we always say the person who's travelled the furthest gets to choose whether they go first or second. I think that's probably you, Greg, from deepest, darkest Sussex.
Well, actually, I am very keen. I know what Ken has chosen, and I'm really keen to hear it, actually. So,
OK, you're going to go second.
Would you like to launch in?
Of course.
It's such a good choice.
All right, Ken, so I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock, and just before we set it off, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Over to you.
What is the best political novel of all time? George Orwell's Animal Farm comes to mind. Devastating critique of communism in the form of a story for children. But what about Les Miserables, Victor Hugo? Or The Prime Minister by Anthony Trollope? And my choice is Uncle Tom's Cabin, published in 1852 and the biggest bestseller of the entire 19th century. First and foremost, it's a classic Victorian page-turner, closely plotted, full of high drama and intense emotion. It grabs you and holds you. Set in Kentucky in the era of slavery, its subtitle is Life Among the Lowly, and it focuses on the slaves. The title character, a slave called Uncle Tom, is a kindly man and a devout Christian, and yet he suffers horribly. This focus was a radical departure for the time. Dickens was considered vulgar for writing about working-class people. The same accusation was aimed at Harriet Beecher Stowe. But that was the least of it. From the first chapter, the author makes it clear, though with prim Victorian discretion, that slaves are used for sex. A coarse character called Haley is visiting Arthur Shelby, the decent white man, and notices a beautiful young woman slave called Eliza. By Jupiter, he says, there's an article now. You might make your fortune on that gal in Orleans any day. I've seen over 1,000 paid down for a gal not a bit handsomer. A Victorian novelist can't say it outright, but all adult readers would have known that Haley is talking about prostitution. Shelby refuses to sell his slaves. He and his wife treat them well in their own eyes. It's clever of the author to start with the best and kindest of slave owners, because that allows her to make the point that the very institution of slavery is evil, regardless of whether the owners are good or bad. Shelby doesn't want to sell slaves, but business setbacks and debts force him to, and the story goes into high gear when Eliza gets wind of Shelby's intention to sell her four-year-old son, and she decides to escape. Uncle Tom is sold at the same time, and the story follows their separate adventures. It's said that soon after the Civil War broke out, a war fought over the issue of slavery, among other things, Abraham Lincoln met the author and was bemused to find her a small and terribly respectable lady. And he said, "So this is the little lady who started this great war."
Oh, oh wow.
Fantastic.
Oh, and with 20 seconds to go. Well done, Ken. Brought it in perfectly. That is wonderful. We'll come back and talk about that book in a few moments. You're going to have a little rest now.
Thank you.
All eyes on Greg, because it's up to you. It's your turn now, Greg, for the 3 minutes. And just before I set you off, what is the book that you're going to...
I'm going to hold that back for till the end. Let's see if you can, from the clues that I offer, work out what it must be.
Oh, you tease. All right, that sounds good. It's 3 minutes on the clock then to tell us about this mystery book. Over to you.
Evolution has prepared the human race to love puzzles. Many thousands of generations training us to think to ourselves, to look around and think to ourselves, well, I know what's going on here. I know what's going to happen next. Now, there was a time, I'm sure you all know, when people spoke about the queens of crime, Allingham, Sayers, Christie. I remember as a child, I must have been 12 or 13, finding an odd sort of book on the shelf, a Reader's Digest abridged hardback containing three detective novels. Two of them I've completely forgotten. I couldn't tell you what they were. But one of them left an absolutely indelible impression. And of course, I've read the full text many times since. That's my book. It's set in a brilliantly rendered Second World War. Well, post-Second World War London, of rationing and shortages in a theatre. We meet the company of actors, and we know that one of them must be murdered. It happens more or less on the middle page, which I think is very audacious and brilliant. And, of course, the pattern at that point is still concealed. Roderick Allen of Scotland Yard arrives and questions all the dazzling dramatis personae about the events that we, the readers, have already witnessed. And he knows, and we don't. The final clue comes from the stage manager, Jacko, French-Canadian, another wonderful character. Alan asks him if he can read German, and Jacko looks at the floor and replies, "Jawohl." No spoilers. It wasn't Jacko who did it. As well as the murder mystery, this relates to something you just said earlier, Ken, compelling and baffling, but oh so clear and rewarding at the end, there's a love story which is so beautifully woven into the investigation of the crime that it seems completely natural. As well as the love story, there's a forensic dissection of theatre mores, as it happens the author's professional milieu. There's a naive, effeminate juvenile bullied by a self-regarding playwright. The gorgeous leading lady whose ephemeral love affairs are brief interludes of grace and charm. And on the other side, the comforting characters among the police, the continuing characters present in all of the author's, almost all of the author's 32 detective novels, comforting as old friends. You could read all 32 in order, spanning the whole of her writing life from 1934 to 1982. And how I would envy you. Above all, I would say, I would envy the reader of this one perfect, understated, but still deeply felt novel. It has a complex mechanism, like a fine watch, jewelled and precise. Seeking the hidden pattern of its movement, you just need to ask your librarian or bookshop owner for Opening Night by...
Naya Marsh.
You got it.
Whoa!
I gave you an extra 2 seconds there.
I think I did just run over that 10 seconds. Oh, dear.
But that's all right, because you had some to borrow from Ken, so it was fine.
Thank you, Ken.
Wow, another brilliant pitch. Both of those I loved. Let's just delve into them a little bit. Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1852, you said, Ken, and what I loved, which I didn't know, the best-selling novel of the 19th century.
Yes.
Unbelievable. And Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote lots more, but not as known?
Oh, what a good question.
I don't know.
She certainly never wrote anything.
I didn't know there was a broader research challenge, Ken, on this show. Did you?
It's a good question because here was something about which she cared absolutely passionately.
Yes.
And none of us has two of those things. I mean, we don't have two of those things in our lives, do we? Not normally, anyway. So
you're reminding me of that brilliant Kipling poem about every person having just one virginity to lose, whether it's to become a sailor or to be, you know, ambition.
One virginity to lose.
And
isn't
only
that
one.
Clever?
Yeah.
But clever, you know, clever is a word that came up in your pitch in terms of her writing here.
And unexpected, Joe. Isn't that the brilliant thing that you sold us? She's such an unexpected person to have conceived of that world.
Yes, she was very respectable, came from a very religious family. Mm. And, of course, Abraham Lincoln was expecting a firebrand because that was the effect of the book. The book was sensational. She was vilified. One of her one of the people who hated the book, you know, all these people said slavery's not that bad. These people are well off. They're looked after. They like it. You know, crazy. Anyway, but it was interesting because, of course, all of those slave owners were Christians. Mm. And they went to church. Yeah. By and large, they weren't villainous people. They were respectable, wealthy, well-dressed pillars of society. And she said to them, you're not Christians. You can't be Christians if you're willing to sell a young girl knowing that she's going to be used as a prostitute. You can't call yourself a Christian. And that drove them up the wall. Mm. That really put them on the spot.
Confronted them with their hypocrisy.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. That's why I think it's the best political novel of all time, because it confronts people with the reality of what they're doing in a way and the way that they absolutely can't escape.
Mm. And that brilliant moment that you were describing, meeting Abraham Lincoln, it's just such an extraordinary...
It's great, isn't it?
Yes, a flash from history.
Yeah, yeah. Not many authors have written a book that started a war.
No.
Yes, absolutely.
And what an incredible woman. And what a brilliant pitch. So thank you for that, Ken. And another one, Greg, opening night. We love puzzles. Yes, we do. We want to know what's going on, or like to think we know what's going on. And I loved that this particular one had such an effect on you as a younger person when you read that sort of collection of stories, and this is the one that not only stood out, but the only one that you remember of it. And 32 novels, is that
right? Yes, it's a monumental career, isn't it?
Wow.
1934 to 1982. And I was saying to Ken earlier that I actually knew late in her life, In the early 80s, I knew her editor, Paul Seide, who helped her publish her final novels.
Wow.
And isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
When you start thinking about life like that across generations and you count back, it is amazing, isn't it, to think that so-and-so, who seems from the dim and distant past, but they're only perhaps three or four generations behind us.
Yeah.
And if... who was it who said to me the other day that if the Queen's father had lived... He would, the same length of life as Queen Elizabeth, he would have lived, well into my lifetime.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
The thing about Naomi Marsh, one of the things, well, first of all, her detective is very unusual because he's posh.
He is posh.
He's a cop.
He's proper posh.
Yeah, but he's posh. And that's an idea that was then pinched by P.D. James. Mm. She also has a detective who's a copper but is posh. It's interesting that you've chosen one of the theatrical mysteries because I think they're the best.
Agreed.
She had obviously a great love of the theatre, and that affection comes out in those mystery stories, murder mysteries set in and around the theatre.
Yeah. And obviously for you as a theatre person, that's just an extra tick, isn't it? Like, that's just another lovely bit.
Yeah, it absolutely is. But if you think back to the very first things that Ken was saying about the strength of identification of the reader with the characters, the understanding of their objectives, their loves, their fears, that's on every page as well. And so Naomi Marsh sets up the story with a young New Zealander, as she once was, adrift in London. We're not sure why at first. She has no resources. Who finds herself by chance, as it seems, at the door of this theatre and takes a job as a dresser when she is, of course, an aspiring actress.
Mm-hmm.
And that draws her into the world in which a murder will eventually take place. And it's something that not many authors are allowed to do these days, to leave the murder till the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I always think that in a murder mystery, that the reader knows there's the promise of murder. And I don't think that a reader would toss a book aside just because it hasn't happened in chapter one or chapter three.
I've just read a book that's very like that. Actually.
Have you?
It's called Maigret Hesitates.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I read Simenon. Part of the reason I read Simenon is he's easy to read in French. And it improves my French.
Super clear, yeah.
Yeah, brilliantly clear writer, very easy to understand. But in Maigret Hesitates, Maigret Hésite, he gets an anonymous letter saying there's going to be a terrible crime. And it's There's no signature, there's no address, nothing. He doesn't know who it comes from. And so he spends most of the book trying to find out where this comes from and who sent it and what is the crime that's about to happen. And it's not actually, I think it's later than halfway through the book that somebody actually is murdered.
But it's promised from the start.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. And it's completely gripping. It absolutely works.
But I'd say as well that Maigret's technique of detection is essentially to stand near to the suspicious people and see what they do.
Isn't that interesting? Mm. And he asks them questions, but they tell him about their life, their job, their husband and wife, their children. And he's just sitting there filling his pipe and listening and letting them ramble on.
And eventually he's absorbed so much that he thinks like they do.
Yeah.
And he knows what it is they must have done and how and when and where and to whom.
Yeah. It's a very character-driven mystery
story. Of course, that's different from Roderick Allen, who is posh, as Ken says. But he's also very, very brilliant. And in a few glances and with a few perceptive questions, he's already close to the heart of the mystery that we're still struggling over. Mm. And then that other thing that I was trying to sell you as an idea, that we see the whole action that leads to the murder and we don't know who did it. And then we see him investigate in the second half of the novel the action that led to the murder, and we still don't know, and he does. It's frustrating but so rewarding as well when the explanation is plausible and convincing.
And does having the murder in the middle page not come back to slightly what we've been discussing, which is you care about the characters, so you're reading on because those characters are actually the story. And yes, the promise of murder is coming, but actually the reason we're turning the page to the middle is because, and as you said, Greg, in your pitch, there's a love story woven in to this book as well as it being, you know, a detective mystery. And that's the key, I think, probably.
Definitely. Yeah, you have to care about it. You have to care about it. I mean, I do like the feeling. I know all these people.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
But what I don't know is something I don't know, because one of them is a murderer.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know. That's great.
Something I often talk about with the playwrights that I work with is as long as the audience stay in their seats, they will find out what happens next. That element of suspense, if you stay with it, you'll find out. But the thing that's much deeper and much more compelling is, why are they doing these things that they're doing? Finding the answer to that question is the really sustaining element of suspense. The why question, not the what.
And you, I have to say, you've brought in a copy of Opening Night here, which I just think is absolutely stunning. And I'm going to take a photo of this, if I may, Greg. And
of course.
We will post that up because that needs to be seen. Just those, I mean, the design of it, you'll see if you look on our social media channels, but that it's just so perfect, isn't it? It's just so beautifully done.
It looks actually, to be fair, it looks a little bit like a melodrama.
Yeah.
And it's actually more subtle and nuanced than that.
Yeah.
But that's okay, isn't it? Because
I just love the colours and the text and it's just...
It draws you in.
Yeah. I always set myself up every episode. I get two brilliant authors in. They give me two brilliant pitches. I want to read both the books that they've talked about, but I've got to take one home. I've got to pick a winner. And winner's the wrong phrase, really.
Oh, I think it's got to be Ken's one, because there's that historical significance that has such importance.
So you've put your vote for Ken's.
Yeah, I would definitely. Okay. I would definitely go Beecher Stowe. Yeah, I think.
Well,
so.
I think, and you know, I believe in fair play and even Stevens.
Yeah,
and
so I
vote for mine as well.
Okay. Well, I'm outnumbered then. So I think, I think we've got to take Uncle Tom's Cabin.
I think
we have to. Yeah, but I have, honestly. 32 novels by Naya Marsh. I've got to go and investigate more because I did not know that she'd written quite so many. And Uncle Tom's Cabin, just such an important book. And I did not know it was the best-selling novel of the 19th century. So I've learnt lots today, as I always do. Thank you both for being here and coming in and talking about your books and these books and other people's books. Never by Ken Follett is out now. It's published by Macmillan. And The Coming Darkness by Greg Moss, also out, published by Moonflower. What an absolute pleasure, gents. We could have stayed here for another hour wanging on about books. Maybe we'll do it again down the pub some other time.
Very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.